from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama makes a pitch for the youth vote, Romney makes his case against the president, Arizona law on trial, and Rupert Murdoch in the hot seat. The president spoke at the University of Iowa on Wednesday and made his case for the future.
I don't want this to be a country where a shrinking number of people are doing really, really well, and then a growing number are barely able to get by. I don't want that future for you. I don't want it for my daughters. I don't want it for America.
Mitt Romney swept five primaries on Tuesday and turned his fire on the president's record.
Is it easier to make ends meet?
No.
Is it easier to sell your home or buy a new one?
No.
Have you saved what you needed for retirement?
No.
And media lord Rupert Murdoch, cool but grilled in London, critics saying his empire corrupted a nation.
I have to admit that some newspapers are closer to my heart than others, I also have to say that I failed.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Romney's wins, Obama's youth push, the Arizona immigration law before the Supreme Court. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Rana Faruhar joins us this week from New York, assistant managing editor and whip smart columnist at Time Magazine. Rana, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
John McCormick joins us from Washington, clear-eyed conservative from the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, the one and only Jack Beattie joins us. Don't get me started on the adjectives there. No end. Hello, hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ron, and John.
Let's go straight to Pastor Mitt Romney here and his call and response in Manchester, New Hampshire. This was on Tuesday. After his primary victories, five, and everybody else is clearing the field pretty much, he went after President Obama's record with kind of echo of Ronald Reagan Romney style.
Are you making more at your job?
No!
Do you have a better chance to get a better job?
No!
Are you paying less at the pump?
No!
You know, if the answer were yes to those questions, then President Obama would be running for re-election based on his record, and rightly so. But because he has failed, he will run a campaign of diversions and distractions and distortions. That kind of campaign may have worked at another place and in a different time, but not here. And not now. It's still about the economy, and we're not stupid.
Mitt Romney, it's about the economy, and we're not stupid. The crowd in Manchester, they're Republicans, sounding a little like Occupy Wall Street. John McCormick, what kind of position do you see Mitt Romney in now? The field is clearing for him. How's it look?
I think it looks pretty good. I still think it's about a 50-50 race. You know, I thought this a couple weeks ago. I still think it's a 50-50 race. Romney obviously trying to make this election a referendum on President Obama. President Obama obviously is the incumbent, you know, with the economy not doing so well, his approval rating not above 50%. He wants to make this a clear choice. So he wants to disqualify Romney. He wants to go after his personal history. Just this week, his campaign managers began talking about him being essentially a plutocrat and, you know, outsourced jobs. And so they're going to be hitting that pretty hard, I think, in the coming days, and bringing up a so-called war on women. So we're going to see a lot of this, and Romney just wants to make it a referendum. I think that right now he's in a pretty good position. Obviously, Obama starts out ahead in the polls, which is never a good thing for Romney. But I think we're going to see this be a tight race, and I expect it to break late. And right now, my hunch is it'll break for Romney at the very end. But I think we're looking at a close race here.
We shall see. Rana Faruhar, there's Mitt Romney echoing Ronald Reagan and referencing Bill Clinton a little bit with it. You know, it's still the economy and we're not stupid. About the economic argument you hear him laying out?
Well, nothing coherent. I mean, there's so much that's disingenuous about what he's saying. And I'll just start with the business about gas prices, because I find the conservative tax on the president about why can't you keep gas lower just to be so ridiculous, particularly coming from Romney, who's someone who professes to understand the global economy. Gas is pegged to oil. Oil is sold on global markets. The reason oil is high is because of fear factors in the Middle East, growth in emerging markets, and to some extent, speculators. And so I'm glad to see President Obama actually trying to turn that debate a little bit by taking on speculators in commodities markets, which I think that he should do. In terms of the economic arguments, the problem is that I have not seen Romney lay out a coherent plan to solve what the real economic problem in this country is, which is bifurcation. There are plenty of jobs where he lives. You know, there's plenty of jobs for the 1% and the 0.0001%. There's a lot of fast-growing, low-paid jobs at the bottom, but there's not much in the middle, and I don't see anything he's said economically about how we're going to grapple with that. And just kind of, you know, making these populist statements and quoting a mishmash of Reaganomics and Bill Clinton is not an answer.
But Jack, here we are. I mean, yes, the hole was deep and it cratered under the last Republican administration, but you can't blame some Americans now. It is a long time later. You know, if you're out of a job or with a lousy job and you're looking around saying, hey, maybe I liked Obama, but is this really working?
And I think that's Romney's edge here, the bad economy and some signs that it may be getting worse. But then when you turn the page and say, all right, well, here's his critique. What would he do differently? Elites in the Republican Party and even attendees at his rallies have been saying, hey, all right, tell us the positive. What's the Romney story? And when you look at that, well, what do you have? You've got a $5 trillion tax cut really canted up to the upper earners. You've got massive unspecified budget cuts. And of these, he says, frankly, they can't be scored, his own plan. You've got a massive defense buildup, and you've got deregulation. Perhaps I'm missing something, but that sounds like George W. Bush revisited.
I don't think you are missing anything.
Well, John McCormick, I want to bring that to you. Let's hear from the vice president for just a minute. He was in New York on Thursday at NYU, praised President Obama, his boss, his partner, the foreign policy record there, was critical of presidential hopeful Mitt Romney on foreign policy and the economy. You'll hear the formula that he's laying down here. We may hear more of this.
I said before, thanks to President Obama, Bin Laden is dead and General Motors alive. You have to ask yourself, had Governor Romney been present, could he have used the same slogan in reverse?
John McCormick, we're way into hypotheticals here now. If President Romney had been president, if Romney had been president, would it be, you know, Obama's alive and General Motors is dead? But what about Rana's critique of Romney saying, all right, there's plenty to complain about in this economy, but where's the Romney plan? What do you see emerging, John, or do you?
Well, I think first is a criticism that President Obama, yeah, of course, you know, he's not responsible for gas prices being high, but he made it marginally worse. You know, I mean, he has not approved the Keystone pipeline to go through. And even Anwar, you know, 10 years ago, people on the left who opposed it said, oh, well, that's not even going to be open for 10 years. Well, now it's 10 years later. That would have helped a little bit. So I think
people
understand
that. But it's important to quantify that margin. That margin, I mean, we've tracked that down here. That you're coming down to pennies a gallon if everything had gone through there. I mean, it still wouldn't be anything like
that. I think that people accurately see that especially with the Keystone Pipeline, I mean, those are real jobs. Those are jobs, and people see that a President Obama, he has values. Listen, he is a man of the left. That's fine. He's a principled liberal. He opposes the Keystone Pipeline because of the environmental lobby. And people understand that, yeah, maybe, obviously, like, those thousands of jobs aren't going to, you know, turn our entire economy around. But people understand that he's made things marginally worse. I mean, Bin Laden and GM, those are two, I mean, yes, of course, Bin Laden. I think anyone would have ordered the raid on Bin Laden. That's great for the
really?
President. But it's do you think Mitt Romney wouldn't have shot Bin Laden in the head if he had a chance?
All I know is that Obama did it, and Osama Bin Laden had been alive for a lot of years before that, since 9/11. That's all.
He had, and the president and the intelligence came in. I'm sure any president, Democrat or Republican, would have made that call. And thankfully, our brave Navy SEALs were successful in that. And I'm glad the president made that call. You know what? He's not campaigning on the signature issue of his administration, which is the health care law. And I think that's telling. That remains deeply unpopular. And, you know, unless the Supreme Court throws it out, that is hanging over the head of business owners of, you know, the entire economy, which I think is a bad law. I don't like it. A lot of Americans don't like it. And I think that's going to be that could be, you know, hurt the president a lot in his reelection efforts if the Supreme Court keeps it in place.
I want to come back to the economy. But if I may, Ron, we'll come back to the economy. But healthcare did come up this week. And it was interesting because it came up in the context of student loans. President Obama out visiting a lot of campuses in swing states and saying, you know, we've got to hold down this interest rate, which is set to go up on a lot of loans. John Boehner came out then on Wednesday and said, hey, you know, we're always for planning to extend low interest rates as long as what the president's called for, but he differed on how to pay for that extension.
Today, I'm pleased to announce that on Friday, the House will vote on a bill to extend the current interest rate on federal student loans for 1 year. And we will pay for this by taking money from one of the slush funds in the president's health care law.
Slush fund, he says, in the health care law. No difference here. We're all for students and low interest rates. Then Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, came out, attacked Republicans for that same that health care source of spending, saying it's an attack on women.
The Republicans say, no, leave the subsidies for big oil intact and let's take it out of our old favorite target, women's health. And that's just wrong.
Jack, we got a lot of kabuki on the student loan interest rate this summer, and we're all on the same page as John Boehner. Just take the money to pay for it out of your health care plan. No problem.
No. And, of course, that's a poison pill for the Democrats. And then in the Senate, the Democrats are saying, well, take the money out of the oil subsidies. That's a poison pill for the Republicans. To say that each side is posturing here is to say the obvious. Whether they'll be able to get together and make something happen, who knows. You know, the president on the hustings, he's been quoting House Republicans saying wild things about student loans, pretending that one of them said that likened them to stage three cancer. Well, of course, he's been misquoting these Republicans. And this is a bad habit the president has got into where he gets revved up and he misrepresents what these people are saying. If you've just said accurately what they were saying, that's objectionable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a week in the news. It's Romney's, it appears, in the GOP. Arizona on trial. We'll look at the Supreme Court consideration there. Walmart in trouble. Obama courts the youth vote. Rana Faruhar is with us from Time Magazine. Assistant Managing Editor there joins us from New York. And John McCormick from the Weekly Standard joins us from Washington, D.C. Jack Beatty's here. And Rana, I promise I want to come back to the economy. But just to the point Jack was making, this was President Obama, University of Iowa, on Wednesday. He went after Missouri GOP Republican Congressman Todd Akin. Now, Akin had said, and I'll quote here, America has got the equivalent of stage three cancer of socialism because the federal government is tampering in all kinds of stuff it has no business tampering in. President Obama, in his quote here, tied that specifically, maybe this is what you mean, Jack, but he took it specifically to student loans. Here's the president.
You've got one member of Congress who compared these student loans, I'm not kidding here, to a stage three cancer of socialism. Stage three cancer? I don't know where to start. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
John McCormick, let me come first to you on this one now. You know, here's Akin talking about stage three cancer of socialism and the president mocking him there. This kind of language about socialism has become pretty common in some quarters on the right. What's going on with this? And is the president right to just raise his eyebrows and say, what the heck are you talking about, sir?
I mean, it's not, I don't think it's politically helpful language. I don't think that it's good for the GOP, which is obviously why the president brought it up. I think that you can make a much more sober-minded critique and just talk about tuition inflation, that the more money that the federal government gives to these student loans, the more and more money universities are going to charge. There are plenty of studies showing a link between the two, that they go hand in hand. In terms of the broader, you know, calling Obama a socialist, yeah, I don't choose to do that. I mean, if you want to parse words here and look to what extent is he representing a democratic socialist, you know, European style welfare state, a turn towards that, as opposed to our traditional, you know, prosperity society with a safety net, which is the way Paul Ryan likes to frame it. I mean, there's not a huge difference there. I mean, everyone right now is on board with Social Security. Everyone is on board with Medicare. I mean, these were denounced as socialism as years passed, and objectively, to a degree, you know, they are social safety net programs, if you want to call them socialism, and not some scary, you know, authoritarian sense or totalitarian sense. I don't know. It's not the craziest thing in the world, but I don't think that kind of language is helpful to the Republican Party. I think that candidate Romney and Republicans in in general should try and be high-minded and keep the tone up. I think that both sides obviously use some very heated language in attacking one another. And yeah, this is a case where I think Republicans would be best off not to, just to call it liberalism. I think that, you know, there's a reason why liberals have rebranded themselves as progressives or call themselves moderates, and conservatives call themselves conservatives in this country because conservatism polls better than liberalism. Mm. So I think I don't see the reason to get into these. I don't see why you can call liberalism socialism when
But there's the president. He's looking right across the border from Iowa into Missouri, and there is Aiken saying stage three cancer of socialism. Rana, what do you make of this battle of? I'm not sure what battle of perspectives or perspective versus the mocking eyebrow cock and reality in the middle of all this.
Well, I'd like to unpack the student debt problem a little bit because it's a very interesting one. For starters, you know, the president is just a great orator, and I love the way he handled that. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that going forward, and that's going to be a big weakness for Romney, who just does not have that kind of pizzazz, can't get the timing right. But in the more important issue of student debt, it is a huge problem. It's over $1 trillion of student debt now. It is an enormous bubble. Now, it's not a bubble a la the mortgage bubble. You can't, you know, back these and turn them into securities.
Yep.
But student loans are with you for life. And these kids are going to come out into a still reasonably depressed job market, and they're going to make less than they would have because of that. And so this is a huge burden going forward. Now, what's interesting, I think it's worthwhile discussing a little bit of historical perspective here. One of the reasons that this debt bubble happened is that everyone from the 70s onward was told, don't go to a two-year technical college program, don't go to a vocational program, you've got to get a four-year degree. And while there is strong data to show that people who have a four-year degree do better going forward, they make more, not all four-year degrees are created alike. There's a difference between Harvard and good state universities and sort of B, C, and D level universities where you're graduating with these kind of faux degrees in sports marketing and not learning any real skills. And so that's why I like to see the fact that the administration is now pushing vocational education back and trying to get companies like Caterpillar, like IBM, to work with educators to come up with two-year programs, which actually are going to be needed to fill a lot of the fastest-growing jobs in the country in the next 5 or 10 years. Get the kids who maybe can't afford the best schools or wouldn't qualify, get them into some two-year programs that can be a starter. You come out earning a decent wage, you have a technical skill, and then go from there. And then you can kind of start to wind the bubble back a bit.
Hey, well, Rana, can we just look straight at the economy, though, beyond the student loan piece? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Mitt Romney is saying, are you better off, kind of like Ronald Reagan, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Now, we've got numbers out today, which are a little weaker again. The recovery has not been strong in any case. You know, there was this sort of ruffle of enthusiasm early in the year, not so strong now. You've got euro problems with us and maybe more on the horizon. How do you see the economy playing out through this campaign season?
Well, I did a Time magazine cover story about a month ago called The Wimpy Recovery. that's kind of how we see it. I mean, the truth is, we are in recovery. We've been in recovery for some time. We're probably going to have somewhere between 2 and 2.5% economic growth this year. That's below what we've had prior to the financial crisis, but it's a heck of a lot better than Europe. The problem is people aren't feeling it because incomes are stagnant. Incomes are stagnant because of this hollowed out middle problem I was talking about earlier. You've got great jobs being created at the top. You've got fast growing jobs at the bottom, but you don't have a lot in the middle. And so I think that's why the debate around manufacturing is going to become very big in the candidacy going forward. I think that Obama has some really interesting ideas on that front. I think Romney hasn't been quite as strong there. I think we need to see plans for how you get mid-level jobs back and how you get Americans the skills to keep those jobs in the country. And we're actually at a good moment for some of those jobs to come back because oil's high. That means people want to keep their supply chains nearby so they don't have to do a lot of expensive shipping. And political risk is going up. You know, Europe's breaking
abroad,
up. China's in chaos.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's become a scarier world all of a sudden, and that favors re-insourcing back to the U.S.
Still, the president out talking to college students, and you've got 54% of graduates under 25 last year unemployed or underemployed.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Jerry, you're on the air. What's on your mind, Jerry?
This is Jerry from Cheshire, Connecticut. I'm calling about the reaction to the Paul Ryan economic plan that Mr. Romney is supporting, and the reaction is coming from the Roman Catholic Church. A week and a half ago, the bishops came out against it. A large segment of the nuns throughout the U.S. came out against it the other day, and then yesterday at Georgetown, quite a few of the professors there and theologians came out against Ryan, calling it an immoral program and taking Catholic doctrine in regards to wages, hours, dealing with housing and human conditions, the encyclicals that have been issued
right.
by the church over the last 125 years.
Yeah, Jerry, let us just look straight at that. Paul Ryan taking some heat this week, and maybe before, but this week in particular, before he went to Georgetown University to deliver a big lecture there. And before he even showed up, dozens of faculty members there sent a letter. They were criticizing his, quote, continuing misuse of Catholic teaching to defend a budget plan that decimates food programs for struggling families, radically weakens protections for the elderly and sick, gives more tax breaks to the wealthiest few. Jack Beattie, join us here. He came back and said, look, you don't have a Paul Ryan came back and said, you don't have a monopoly on interpretation of Catholicism. And, you know, back off a little bit here, Jack, the House Budget Committee chairman.
Yes, and he did a little backing off himself. He has been on the record as saying that Ayn Rand is his favorite philosopher and he's a devotee. And I think this week or just recently he said, no, I'm she's an atheist. I if you want to find out what I believe, look at Thomas Aquinas. Well, of course, that's beyond all of us. But I'm not an expert on Catholic social doctrine. But it does seem to me that the Sermon on the Mount and the idea that the poor are exalted and helped isn't consistent with the premise of the Ryan budget, which is to take from the bottom and to give to the top. I mean, that is just a fact. That's just what the cuts would do. And of course, Ryan has said, oh, I'm not specifying any cuts. But just last week, we got the Agriculture Committee voting massive cuts to make way for the Ryan budget in what? Food stamps. Now, if it were just cuts in programs, you'd say, well, it's a hard medicine. We all have to do it. But it's coupled with this big tax cut program for the wealthy. So it's very hard to see how it squares with at least an amateur's idea of Christianity.
Let's see what some of our listeners think here. Jerry in Tallahassee, Alabama. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We were talking about the entitlements, and when politicians talk about it, they talk about it as if it was a dirty word. Having put money into Social Security for 47 years, not only as an individual, but as an employer, I kind of take umbrage at that term.
What, do you see it? It should be an entitlement? It is an entitlement? Or what's your problem with it, Jerry?
The way they talk about it as if I was getting something that I had no business getting. After putting in money 47 years for matching as an employer,
yep,
as well as my own money,
yep,
I think I'm due that. And if people want to do away with it, great. Give me my money back and away we go.
So where does that leave you leaning as you look toward the fall election, Jerry?
Oh, well, I told you almost a month ago I was voting for Mitt. It's a real simple election for me. It's not Democrat and Republican. It's home of the free and land of the brave. And
so do you think Mitt Romney, you think the czarist, you think Mitt Romney is more likely to stick up for your Social Security that you've paid into? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. We got it. Good luck to you. Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more right here. Arturo in Montreal. You're on the air, Arturo.
Yes. Hello, Tom. I wanted to just mention on the issue of the Mexican scandal with the Walmart. We know that there is a presidential election coming up in July, and it seemed that the party PRI may benefit from this scandal, the party that was in power for 70 years, because it shows that the current president, Felipe Calderon, in his tenure and before that, the PAN party president, they yep. gave out a lot of these permits to Walmart to expand in Mexico, in places they shouldn't be, They had the permission to build around the historical pyramids north of Mexico, which it creates a problem because it did create jobs, the Walmart, but it also invaded on the cultural identity of Mexico. And also a problem with Walmart is it had not always respecting the agricultural local farmer, and it expanded too quickly. There was a lot of corruption under Calderon, and I think this scandal exemplifies how corrupt this government was, and I think that the upcoming election will show that PRI will come back to power, which is a party that is a symbol of a stronger Mexican identity. So in this sense, this scandal is very detrimental for the current president.
Arturo, we've got that your perspective, and I appreciate it. We'll look more at the Walmart scandal. John McCormick, what do you make of this? Walmart with a huge number of outlets in Mexico now at the end of this big decade-long push. I think I heard in the last year they were opening a new Walmart every single day of the year. Just an incredible speed. And now it turns out that this lot of reporting bears up, and it looks pretty well substantiated that there were plenty of bribes going on to make that happen and then some kind of cover-up here. Is this what it takes to compete out in the world, John? How does this play out? Walmart has made a big point of its ethical stance over the years, and then this.
I mean, it's very troubling, I think, what's happened in Mexico. I think this is obviously a big problem for Walmart. You shouldn't be, you know, doing unethical things in any country. But it also speaks to the lawless state of Mexico right now. I mean, given the civil war going on, it's kind of the Wild West out there.
Civil wars?
Not quite civil war, but I mean, the drug war is, you know, thousands and thousands have been killed in this drug war to a point where civil society is just so torn apart. I think this is just one of the smaller signs of how civil society has deteriorated in Mexico in these past years.
Rana, it's kind of mind-blowing. You think about a lot of American downtowns who got hollowed out when Walmart opened on the edge of town here in Mexico with 2,000. How many now? Just an enormous number per capita of Walmarts there. In some sense, Walmart must now kind of own retailing in this very large country.
Well, you know, it's one of many players, and bribes are rife in the retail sector and in Mexico in general. But I think what this case speaks to is actually the problems that U.S. multinationals are encountering and are going to continue to encounter as they get a larger and larger share of their revenues from emerging markets. You know, about 60%, 30 to 60%, let's say, of the biggest multinationals in the U.S. get their revenues, that percentage of their revenues from these markets. We're talking about Mexico, China, Russia, India, Brazil. And guess what? These countries don't score real well on the corruption measures. So there is a lot of pressure. But the bottom line is that under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, it's all illegal. And I think that this is going to be a very costly and very long process for Walmart. And I think it's going to be one of these sort of seminal cases where everybody, I can guarantee you, every general counsel at every multinational right now is having a meeting and they're going through and making sure that there's nothing hidden in the closet.
Do you see a threat to corporate Walmart in this? I mean, how big could the penalties be? The U.S. federal law is very tough on corruption abroad.
Well, sure I do. I mean, in that wonderful, wonderful New York Times investigative piece, and I'm thrilled that there's still that kind of investigative corporate journalism going on, actually it was embedded in about page 5, but the reporter noted that there were 31 cases that had been brought to attention at that point, and that they hadn't been investigated, many of them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, former Liberian President Charles Taylor became the first former head of state since World War II to be convicted of war crimes by an international court at The Hague. A survivor of the wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone responded.
Justice has been done today. Yeah, justice has been done not only for Sierra Leone, but for all Africa.
In the NBA, L.A. Lakers player Meta World Peace viciously elbowed Oklahoma City's James Harden in the head. He's suspended for 7 games. Mike Breen and Jeff Van Gundy of ESPN reviewed the epic shot to the head.
Let's take a peek. Oh, that's disgraceful. That's not only ejection, that's going to be a suspension and should be. What a disgrace.
And the president plays it cool, slow jamming the news on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon.
Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Preezy of the United Steezy.
We're looking at the United Steezy. We're looking at a week in the news with Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beattie. Let's go right to our listeners. Henry in Charleston, South Carolina. Henry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
All right. What do you see?
I just wanted to make a comment that I think the people that you have on the panel are a little bit, out of it today. I was working 4 years ago. I was working a minimum wage job, barely making it. And, I mean, since the president came in, I am a Republican. But, however, since the president came in, I was able to start a business, hire five people. And now my business is growing, and I'll have, 10 vehicles by the end of the year. I currently have five. So to say that what the president has been doing hasn't helped, I think the panelists and the news media is a little bit out of it because I'm in the real world.
Hey, Henry, it sounds like you're on a roll, and we're delighted for that. But, you know, people are also looking at overall growth rates and what's happening overall, and it hasn't been super strong. But somehow you're finding your way, and that experience, absolutely, credible. It's yours. Let's get one more. Walt in Pittsburgh. Walt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that, you know, the country, if you look at the country instead of individuals, that the country is in a better position than we were in 2008, that you know, we're not losing the hundreds of thousands of jobs a month and you know, business is going out of business, the housing problem is improving.
Well, I guess, but still big problems there. 54% of graduates under 25 years old last year unemployed or underemployed. How good is that, Walt?
Yeah, but it's better than it was in 2008.
The
situation is better.
Yeah, we got it. We got it. Walt, I appreciate your call. Let's go to Jill in Waterloo, Iowa. Jill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I agree with the commentator who stated that if we have Romney for president, we will just have George Bush all over again. If you want to know what a Republican administration would look like, all you need to do is look around the country at the states where there are Republican governors, where workers' rights are being attacked, where where voting is being suppressed, and economically, if you look at income distribution in the last 30 years, it is all gone to the very top. The top 1% is off the graph. The middle class has been flat the entire time, and the working and poor have gone down.
Yeah, so Jill. No, we know those numbers.
We have to look forward to.
Oh, we know those numbers, Jill. Though, you know, who's going to take it where? I mean, Rana Faruhar, John McCormick says, let's get back to the prosperity and opportunity economy, and that's the Romney promise, Rana.
Well, you know, it's the Romney promise, but how is it going to be executed? I think the fact is, if you're going to have an optimistic view in the next 5 years, you're going to have to invest, and particularly in education. And the thing is, we're playing on a global playing field now, and you know, this issue touches immigration, it also touches education. We have to make the smartest, most employable people in the world feel welcome in our country, and that goes to the Arizona immigration issue. We have to make our own people at home better educated K through 12 and at the university system. I think President Obama has a much more cohesive plan. I mean, just last week you heard Arne Duncan talking about rolling out a new pilot program to blend high school into community college. Rahm Emanuel in Chicago is picking up in this. This is going to create jobs that actually graduate kids, high school kids, that also have a two-year community college degree packed in, and it leads them to real jobs. They've got a job waiting for them at the end. So there are plans here. I don't see Romney talking about real plans like that. I mean, I know he knows how to buy and sell companies. I know that's what private equity does. I don't see the real value there, and I don't see the job creation.
John, Ron is tough on Romney. Romney, let me come back to you once more on that front. And what you see in terms of, you know, nitty gritty, he has been, you know, the etch-a-sketch has been a little blank, not blank, but not full of detail on his economic plans. What do you see coming?
Well, he has said that he would sign the Ryan budget. Obviously, he's been reluctant mm-hmm. to embrace it entirely, I think, but he said if it came across his desk, he'd sign it. President Obama and the Democrats are just licking their chops. They think this is a great issue for them to really make it more about a choice than a referendum on the president himself because, you know, there are, you know, there is a Medicare reform in there 10 years down the road for people who begin to get on Medicare. Everybody would be grandfathered in. So I think that the president would like to make this about the Ryan budget. I think that the Democratic National Committee wants to make it about the Ryan budget.
Well, shouldn't
and
he?
I think I mean, that is a plan. I mean, you can criticize it, but I mean, the idea is that there will be tax reform and that's pro-growth, and you can attack that as tax cuts for the wealthy. As Ryan points out, 8 out of 10 small businesses file as individuals, so he wants to close some deductions at the bottom and have revenue-neutral tax reform and bring down the rates for everybody. And in terms of the budget, you know, one thing that might be hurting our economy right now is that there's uncertainty about our debt and where are we going to go off the cliff in 2, 5, 10 years and end up like Greece. That's what the Ryan budget tries to avert. It's interesting. It's actually so gradual that it takes, you know, at least 20 years to get to balance.
Why revenue neutral then? If we've got this debt danger, why be revenue neutral? I've seen serious critics say, come on, Mitt Romney, you're a smart businessman. You know, we need some revenue in here. Revenue neutrality moves us closer to that cliff you're talking about, John.
Yeah, I mean, historically, we've had about 19% or 18% of GDP as our federal government. I think that if in the end, if this is their starting position, I mean, Pat Toomey, who is used to head up the Club for Growth, the right-wing Club for Growth, mm-hmm. he came up with a plan that had some revenue in there. Paul Ryan supported it. I think that there is, you know, John Boehner came in, and he actually wanted to go much farther than them. It wasn't as specific, but he wanted to take $1 in revenue for every $4 in cuts, and President Obama himself rejected that in a news conference.
Well, Mitt Romney held his hand up and rejected one in revenue for 10 in cuts.
He did, and I think that if it came down to it, if that were actually to come down, I'm sure that they'd be for it. The point is that I think that if something like that, if a good deal like that ever came across their desk, I'm sure that a President Romney would sign it. I mean, the whole idea of
we remember the photograph of his hand in the air, and I'm sure that would be pulled out. I don't know. Maybe you're right,
And President Obama said that an individual mandate was the worst thing in the world, and Hillary Clinton was terrible. People campaign on certain things and change their minds in office. And I'm sure if a legitimately good, budget deal came through, that'd be great. And what they can point out is that the president has never produced a budget that ever gets to balance. So this is a huge problem hanging over our economy, over our entire country. And where's the president's solution? He's been in office for all this amount of time. And especially when he brings up all these new little shiny initiatives like the Buffett rule. I mean, he had 60 Democratic senators. He had a huge, huge majority in the House of Representatives. Why didn't he act on these things then when he could?
Our listeners, BHA says Romney and his 1% buddies are certainly better off than they were 3 years ago. Gretchen says Obama owns this failure. And despite his pledge not to make excuses, they're all he's got. I want to turn to Arizona and the Supreme Court just because it's a big issue right along a lot of American states. And there it is in the court. Arizona with its tough show us your papers law that has been blocked in lower courts. But the Supreme Court seemed notably open to the Arizona position. Here's Arizona Governor Jan Brewer outside the Supreme Court on Wednesday saying she feels pretty confident that the justices will uphold her state's immigration law.
I thought that the hearing went very, very, very well. I feel very confident as I walked out of there that we will get a favorable ruling in late June.
But others were sort of rolling their eyes and saying, what's going on? Here on the same day, Democratic Congressman Luis Gutierrez of Illinois spoke out against the Arizona immigration law. Arizona sort of taking things in its own hands.
It is clear that in America, we should not have laws in which 50 states have 50 different ways of treating immigration policy.
Jack, the lower courts went heavily against the Arizona law, but here's the U.S. Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, and it sounded pretty friendly on Wednesday.
It did. And, I'm not a legal expert, but I question the government strategy here. I mean, they went with this facial challenge that the Supremacy Clause says this immigration regulation is in the hands of the federal, not the state government. The Constitution says that trumps state government.
And that seems to be, rather than the obvious, it seems to me, and really umbrageous part of this law, which is the show your documents part of it, which is the racial profiling that's just implicit in that, and the invitation to it that's implicit in that. And that's not the ground that this is being decided on. In fact, John Roberts quickly made, he said to General Verrilli, am I right? We're not talking about racial profiling here. We're talking about the supremacy. Yes, that's right. And then it made clear that he didn't buy the Supremacy Clause argument. So I'm just puzzled why what seems like the really objectionable civil rights part of this isn't at the center of their case.
John McCormick, what do you make of the Roberts Court apparent friendliness toward Arizona on this issue? How do you interpret it?
Yeah, I think that they're, generally think this is a law that should be up to the states. I think that this would be better as an as-applied challenge if, obviously the law, Jack just said it's implied that there is racial profiling and the law says you should not do racial profiling. But if, in fact, every single person who looks to be of Mexican-American, ancestry, that they're getting pulled over for going a mile over the speed limit, or every time that they jaywalk, they're getting checked and then they're asked to see their papers. I mean, that's obviously a problem, I think, and I don't know how the courts would decide on that, but I think that if this is just a law, if the law is carried out as they say it is, in the course of stopping someone for another issue, a legitimate issue that they are asked to, show proof of citizenship, their ID, I don't think that's a terribly an unjust law. I think that I don't live in Arizona, but I think that that's a very popular law, and I at the very least, I think Arizona has the right to enact that law, and if it carries it out as it states in the law.
Sounds like the court may be sympathetic to that view. We talked a lot about it in this last week and heard from Arizonans that it's not as popular as it was. It gets tricky when you get into show us your papers. But Joseph in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to make a comment really quick. I work in a very good restaurant in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Economy is great, but illegal immigration, when it comes to that, the only people that are actually benefiting are the owners of the restaurant. None of them actually even get paid any overtime for any work that they do.
You mean immigrants don't get paid overtime, you're saying?
Their response is if you want to keep your job, you'll keep quiet. And then the funny part is even the wait staff is in the same situation, because their response is also, well, you get paid 40 hours, but you're based on tips, so your tips are the important parts, unless you want to lose the job, just keep quiet.
So, Joseph, does that leave you wanting tougher enforcement or not?
It does. It does in certain ways. The enforcement not meaning towards kicking people out of the country, but enforcing businesses to actually do what's right. I mean, sure, you're supposed to register all of your employees. Businesses still aren't doing it. They'll pay anybody off the books in order to keep cheap wages, and until it's enforced on the business side of it, and tougher regulation against the actual businesses, I don't see it really changing.
Joseph, I appreciate your call. Ron, I want to turn with you for a moment, if we may, across the pond to the UK. We've seen so many big headlines there about the Murdoch media empire and the, busting into people's cell phone messages and pressure that was or wasn't brought to bear to let Rupert Murdoch buy B Sky, be huge television outfit there, pressure against the BBC and all that. This week he was sitting there saying, he said that there was a cover-up at his organization, but maintained that he, this is Rupert Murdoch, testified, was the victim, not the perpetrator.
Oh, boy.
There's
no question
in my mind that maybe even the editor, but certainly beyond that, someone took charge of a cover-up, which we were victim to, and I regret.
A cover-up which we were victim to, and I regret, and sorry to step on it there, Ron, but just let me run one little bit more here from the Prime Minister, David Cameron. He told a jeering crowd in Parliament on Wednesday that British politicians from all parties had become too close to News Corp head Rupert Murdoch.
We all did too much cozying up to Rupert Murdoch.
There was a cover-up, Rana, and Rupert Murdoch says he was a victim to it.
Well, let me start by saying I was a foreign correspondent for a number of years in London, and the media and politicians do have a much cozier would be putting it very politely, cozier arrangement with each other than they do in the U.S. And Murdoch is, of course, at the head of those sorts of relationships. I have a very hard time drawing a picture of Rupert Murdoch as a victim in my mind. I think I would be...
Of his own editors, no less.
Of his own editors, yeah, exactly, that he handpicks and hires. As I understand it, and I know some of the people who worked those papers, he's got ink on his hands. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, to his credit, loves newspapers and really is into old media. So I have a hard time feeling like this guy didn't know anything when I know for a fact from friends that have worked at these papers that he was in newsrooms, that he makes calls, that he comments on stories. So I find that, I don't know the facts, but I find it very hard to believe.
John McCormick, News Corp used to have a hand in your organization, Weekly Standard. Do you think it's good for this a bit of humbling to go on in the UK, to sort of right the scales here? How do you look at it, John?
Yeah, I guess technically I was a former News Corp employee till a few years ago. How do I look at it? I think that, I do extend, innocent till proven guilty. I think that we shouldn't be speculating. If I'm going to speculate, honestly, from what I saw, I can't imagine Rupert Murdoch being that involved at that level. Just I don't imagine President Obama was involved with the GSA and handpicking this guy who, you know, did some scandal under his nose, you know. People do things that the top person doesn't know about in such a large organization.
Jack, you know, it's we've got the web now, but I'm glad we don't have the giant press barons of quite that scale in this country. Pushing policy, Jack.
Yes, the country's too big, and thank God for that.
Jack Beatty, John McCormick, Rana Faruhar, great to have you all with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. There's a week. This is On Point.